The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alok Jha, and this is a special edition of Science Weekly, all about the origin of life.
I think this is the best model we have for that origin of life, and that actually the first life forms and the first evolutionary split, the first origin of species, was in fact not a free living entity at all. It was a life that was bound in rock.
We're speaking to Adam Rutherford, who's a biologist and an editor at Nature magazine. He's just published a new book, Creation, The Origin and the Future of Life. We asked Adam to come in to talk about the first part of that book, The Origin of Life. Where did life start? How on earth do we scientifically test it? And ultimately, why do we even want to know? Adam, welcome back to the podcast. Your book obviously is about the origin of life and also the future of life in two bits. I think we've discussed synthetic biology quite a lot, haven't we? So why don't we focus on that first bit, the origin of life? To you know, paraphrase a great scientist, what is life?
Well, we don't have a really good definition of what life is. In fact, there have been many attempts over the last few decades to get a definition of what life is. I'm not sure that it's actually a useful...
You say that. Mrs. Gren, though.
Okay, so that's... Mrs. Gren is, for listeners who remember, is the list that we get taught, the acronym for things that life does. And so it stands for movement, respiration... sentience. I can't remember what the rest of them are. What
Gren.
Are they? Help me out here. Yeah, grens.
Growth. Respiration. Reproduction.
Excretion.
Yeah. Okay. So there is Mrs. Gren.
So when you're 15, you know this. When you do biology, but that is a list. That's a checklist of things that life does, and I don't think that is a definition of what life is. I'm not convinced that defining life is a useful exercise, because it's kind of like more like a process. It's a sort of continuum of a sort of concatenation of lots of different things rather than being a singular thing. A lot of people don't think that. A lot of people think that it is basically genetics. It's if like you can reproduce information and it changes over time, like descent with modification, as Darwin said, then that is fundamentally what life is. But I think one of the things I argue in the book is that there are more basic processes that underlie reproduction, which is the R in Mrs. Gren, and that's a better way of looking at what life actually is. So the first person to ask that question in a formal way was a physicist, was Schrödinger, he of trapping a cat in a box fame. He gave a series of public lectures in the 1940s and wrote it up as a pamphlet called What is Life? And he gave a very much a physicist's view on it, which was to do with energy and the second law of thermodynamics. Haldane wrote a book a few years later called What is Life? But it was much more about evolution. And in chapter 14, he opens chapter 14 by saying, I'm not going to attempt to define what life is, which is a bit of a swizz if you've called your book What is Life?
Well, but without the definitions, though, isn't it hard to then go off and find, we'll talk later about experiments that are trying to recreate the beginnings of life on Earth. Isn't it harder, rather, to find what those experiments might be showing you and work out whether you have got the beginnings of life or not, if you haven't got a definition?
I think you have to look at the things that life does, so maybe some of the things on the Mrs. Gren checklist, and use them to inform your experiments. We're not at a stage yet where we will be able to reproduce the origin of life and create something akin to a cell. We're a long way from that process, but there are several pockets of activity in origin of life biology or science more generally, where they're looking at fundamental aspects of cellular life, so how the membrane works, how it might form spontaneously, how DNA and RNA came to pass as being the way that information is transferred through the generations. And then there is the thing that I think underlies all of those activities. Everything on Mrs. Gren's list requires energy, right? So you can't have DNA replication, you can't have evolution unless you've got an energy harnessing system inbuilt into the cell. We call it metabolism, basically. But I think that identifying that as an origin of life event is probably the most sensible way of approaching this.
Well, let's come at that question from the beginning then. Tell us what we know about the evolution of life on Earth to the first microbes. I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, how higher order mammals and all that evolved, but just simply, what do we think, at some point life started, mm-hmm. when was it, where was it? What do we know?
Well, we've got. Sometimes I joke that physicists have been struggling to come up with a grand unifying theory of everything for about several thousand years and systematically failed, whereas in biology we've actually done it really convincingly three times in the space of 100 years. And they all say the same thing. So that's DNA. So this is going to go out next week, which will be the 60th anniversary of Crick and Watson's double helix, right? That was the most recent one. Darwin, 1859, comes up with the theory of natural selection, theory of evolution by natural selection. And before that, there's cell theory, which is very uncontroversial, but basically says that all life is made of cells and all cells can only come from existing cells. Right? Now, you put all those three things together. They all say the same thing. They all say that life is derived from the things that came before it. So we talk about the tree of life. If you track back from any organism or any individual cell within an organism, on us right now, you can track a pathway via that process of cell division, transfer of information, and evolution from now back all the way about 4 billion years. And what we know from molecular biology, what we know from the fact that DNA is shared between all organisms, the language of DNA is the same in all organisms that we've ever observed. The orientation of the various molecules of the cell is exactly the same in all organisms ever observed. We logically are drawn to a single point at the very root of the tree of life, not multiple roots, it doesn't appear to be any evidence to suggest that that life forms emerged in parallel with each other. There appears to be a single entity, well, we call it LUCA, the last universal common ancestor, which is, in a sense, a cell from which all other life on Earth had evolved. Now, we think that...
Is LUCA an actual... I mean, is it a cell? Is it a concept more than a particular organism?
It's kind of helpful to think about it as a cell. It's probably more of a concept. It may have been a community of cells sharing information or something like that. Bill Martin, who's one of the proponents of the origin of life that I support, he says that LUCA means different things to different people, and I tend to agree with that. But it's a useful concept. I mean, the tree of life is a very useful concept. There are many problems with the tree of life as a real scientific model, but it is a useful concept, and LUCA is a useful concept in the same way. We think that LUCA existed about 3.9 billion years ago. We see fossils of cells about 3.5, 3.6 billion years ago, but we see the traces, the chemical signatures locked in rock of life about in that sort of time frame, almost 4 billion years ago. And it also coincides with the end of a period known as the Late Heavy Bombardment, which was 300 million years of intense meteoric activity in the local neighbourhood that was... Some calculations have worked out that it was enough to pulverize the land many times over, enough energy to boil the oceans many times over, sterilization events. If there was life at this time, there would have been sterilization events regularly.
So in a sense, though, the LUCA is the thing that all of our current life comes from, but there might have been other branches of that tree which just completely died out. It's the last survivor, the last survivor we can think of.
Definitely. That's exactly right. All life that we know of is all of the mechanics of life, all the DNA is shared, and so we've got this idea that everything has evolved from a single origin. But that's not to say that it's the only life that's ever existed on Earth. It may have been that there were many different types of life forms at any point between the origin of the Earth 4.5 billion years ago and 3.9 billion years ago, but the only one that survived is the one that we evolved from.
Well, given these constraints, then you've got something happening. Obviously, so long ago, there's scant, if any, fossil evidence for it. You've got a situation in the early Earth where the rocks are being pulverized regularly, and nothing survives. Mm. How do you start to then wind the clock back to work out how this spark happened?
Right, so another good question. We do have no rocks. You're right, from older than 3.9 billion years ago. That because they were pulverized by this meteoric activity. So we don't have any fossils from the first... We don't have any rocks, we don't have any fossils from the first period of Earth's existence. We know about the Late Heavy Bombardment because we went to the moon, and so analyzing the moon rocks and analyzing the craters, which are not subject to metamorphosis or plate tectonics or just atmosphere withering them. There is no atmosphere on the moon, so they're like a permanent record of what happened in the early solar system. And we see this meteoric activity, so we can know things about the Hadean, which is the first period of the Earth's existence, also referred to as the cryptic era. We know about the age of the Earth from looking at crystals, zircons they're called, so that they have a particular characteristic, which is they trap radioactive material, and we can date the Earth as a result of that. And we can also see within those that same sort of chemical detective work that we see the emergence of life-specific chemicals that can only exist if they have been through a metabolic process. So even though there aren't rocks or fossils, we can still know things about that era. Science is clever like that.
And you could, and traditionally, experiments that have sort of probed this area have tried to recreate some of those conditions to try and work things out. So tell us about the sort of famous experiments in the 60s where this happened.
Yeah, exactly. So it's 1953, in fact. So Stanley Miller's...
The 50s.
The 50s, a bit before the 60s.
The bit before the 60s, yeah.
It's the 60th anniversary, in fact, of Stanley Miller's iconic experiment. And he was a PhD student, 22 years old, working for Harold Urey, who was a Nobel Prize winner, and suggested to Urey that he would set up this beautiful rig of sealed glassware wired to about 10,000 volts. And in it, he trapped various elements, various molecules that we thought were present, he thought at the time were present on the early Earth, and swirled them around, right? Put a spark of electricity across them, heated them up, let the experiment run.
This is Darwin's warm little pond.
Exactly. So Darwin first came up with this idea that if you got the ingredients right, then life or more complexity and ultimately life might emerge. It was formalized as a scientific idea in the 1920s, referred to as what everyone knows as the primordial soup. So Miller in 53 puts together this rig, boils it up. His supervisor says, if nothing happens after 6 months, then shut it down, we'll move on to something else. Within a couple of weeks, the liquid goes pink and then brown. They take a sample out, analyze it, and it's packed full of five amino acids. And amino acids are the building blocks of proteins, and proteins are what all life is made of or by.
So that sounds tantalizing.
Absolutely. So the press went nuts for this. He was on the cover of worldwide magazines. People speculated that he had created life in a lab, and that is not what had happened. It was an incredibly important and iconic experiment, and showed very clearly that if you got the ingredients right, you could create biological molecules that are essential for biology. But that doesn't answer the question of what life is and whether you can actually keep going down that pathway until you get to an actual life form. So it showed categorically that you can make biological molecules without biology. And that was a really important step. But in a sort of cultural sense, it reinforced this notion that primordial soup was a valid scientific idea. And in the book, I argue that it's not, because it doesn't address what we were talking about earlier, this fundamental underlying property of life, which is the ability to harness energy from its environment.
So what happens next with the Miller-Urey experiments then? I mean, they show that you've got these chemicals. It's not conclusive proof of the beginning of how life started on Earth. So what's next? How do you then start to probe that?
Well, there were a lot of... It's an interesting field, the origin of life science, because it's so difficult to know what happened, and because it's such a long time ago, there's a lot of talk. It's a field which is dominated by not a lot of experimentation and quite a lot of talk. Now, the primordial soup idea really stuck. I think there are complex reasons for that. One is it's a really catchy name, right? And that makes a big difference when you've got a name for something that people talk about it a lot. And the experiments are things that you can work out what the right experiment to do is. You know, we know many elements of how cells are put together. So you could theoretically put together an experiment where you want to see the emergence of a cell membrane or a bit of DNA or a protein, as Miller did. And so, you know, it's the idea of the warm little pond, get the ingredients right and the right things will emerge. And those types of experiments went on through between the 50s and they're still going on today. The another idea emerged, which is very similar, but in a much more mature way, about the origin of information. So we are information bearers, that's contained within our DNA. But it's very difficult to imagine that DNA would arise spontaneously, because it's very complex and difficult to synthesize molecule. But in the 70s and 80s, this concept called the RNA world hypothesis began to emerge, which was that the conundrum of DNA being a code and proteins being active could be bypassed by having the first informational molecules as being RNA.
It's maybe worth explaining what the sort of the relationship between DNA and protein is at this point. I mean, just in terms of, so in every life form on Earth, DNA is the code which is passed down through generations, through modification, etc., which then is actually a code for proteins, which the proteins is what everything is in terms in life. But proteins can't pass on any information, and DNA can't replicate, or can't, it doesn't do anything really apart from carry the code and replicate itself.
That's right, yeah.
So in the middle of that is RNA, which is the single-stranded version of DNA,
yeah,
which sort of translates between the two.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's a bit of a chicken and egg problem in the sense that you can't get DNA replication unless you've got proteins, and proteins are encoded in DNA. So how do you break that circle? But there is this missing step in the middle, which Francis Crick named as the central dogma, which is, it goes, DNA makes RNA makes protein. Now, RNA is this middle step. It's an intermediary molecule, which is, it contains genetic information, but it's a single helix. And it does something quite clever, which is that it can contain information like DNA, but it also can act as an enzyme, like proteins do. And so the idea is that before we had DNA and before we had proteins doing their things that we see in every cell, in every organism now, RNA could do both jobs. And so you have this idea of the RNA world, where the first biochemistry, the first genetic material, as it were, was actually not DNA, but was RNA. And then experiments to determine, to reinforce that as an idea have been really, really seriously impressive. So 2010, a group in California led by a guy called Jerry Joyce, they put together an RNA molecule, which the only function of which is to reproduce itself, right? So two versions of the same molecule lock together, and they catalyze the production of itself again. And it will do that ad infinitum. It is a truly impressive experiment. So in a sense, you've got the first, what you might describe as the first gene there. And also they notice that you know, evolution is not about perfect replication at all, or else we wouldn't evolve, we just replicate. Evolution is about imperfect replication. And so they saw that, you know, they recognized that in this experiment, and they, after they'd perfected perfect replication, they then introduced errors into this RNA molecule, and they saw a Darwinian process. They saw the selection of random variants of this molecule that worked better, that catalyzed their own self-replication better. And so, you know, this becomes a really strong model for the origin of genetics. Again, and this is what I argue in the book, I don't think it represents the origin of life. I think it represents the origin of genetics, the origin of evolved descent. But that whole process requires energy for it to happen.
Because at the moment, you're just talking about molecules that are repeating, copying themselves endlessly for no purpose other than to make more molecules themselves.
Yeah.
But at what point does that become DNA?
Mm-hmm.
Where does the second helix come from?
Well, you got to remember that, I mean, these are tiny, tiny pieces in a huge puzzle, and we're trying to piece them together. We can see how this bit of genetics might have evolved from naught, or we can see something about how the cell membrane might have evolved from naught. And so we're a long way from putting them together into a linear pathway. The RNA world, which is a speculative idea, because it doesn't exist anymore. If it was the origin of genetics, it has been entirely lost to history. It doesn't exist in any form now. But some really good experiments have tried to model the way that we would have gone from that RNA world to the DNA world that we see in all living things. And they're impressive experiments and calculations about the fidelity of the information that you can contain within RNA compared to the fidelity that we know happens in DNA. So you get this Darwinian concept introduced at this stage as well, which is competition. One of these experiments looks at how the levels of fidelity in transferring information from RNA to DNA, or the reverse. And you see, strikingly, that it works in one direction really well, but not in the other direction. So this concept is that it's called DNA takeover. So the RNA world became the DNA world because DNA is a more robust form of data storage than RNA.
Outcompeted the DNA, RNA rather.
Exactly. One of the things I do in the book, so to try and describe that, is to use Google Translate to show that, to ask the question, if you translate a sentence using an automatic translator and then back again, do you get the same message out the other side? And what I spent ages trying to get good examples of this, because I took a sentence from the book and I plugged it into Google Translate in Icelandic. This is what I settled on. And if you do it in Icelandic, push it through Google Translate, and then take that phrase in Icelandic and translate it back into English. And in the sentence I used, it changes the grammar and it makes it ugly, but the information is retained. And I did exactly the same process using Czech, and it changes it absolutely inverts the meaning. So it swaps two of the words around, meaning that the information has been altered in a detrimental way. So in a sense, that is reflective of the takeover from RNA to DNA. That works better than in any other direction.
So again, as you said, we're putting these little pieces together. We've been talking about genetics so far, the sort of emergence of genetics. What about cells? What about the idea that, because you need to contain this stuff,
yeah.
And then replicate it and so on. What do we know about the earliest cells?
Yeah, so there's two stages to this. And I think that the model that I settle on, the model that I think is the best description for how we see life on Earth, is based around a particular type of submarine hydrothermal vent, right? So a rip in the ocean floor that we discovered in about 2000. And the various chemicals that we see emerging create a specific type of rock which has a pore-like structure to it. It's like a sponge, but it's solid. So, and the shape of the pores are, you know, almost bacterial cell size. Now, there's a lot of complex biochemistry going on in there, but some of it reflects the biochemistry that we see, the energy-generating biochemistry that we see in cells. So one idea is that the first biochemical reactions, the first types of proto-metabolism, occurred locked in these chambers, in this sort of honeycomb chambers in these types of hydrothermal vents. And actually, that's where you get the first biochemistry, and you might model that later on, if that process continues, later on that's where the RNA world might exist, that you go from basic metabolism and biochemistry into basic genetics. And then there's a further model, which is that actually the types of metals that are bubbling around and inside these pores are actually the types of metals that catalyze the spontaneous formation of bacterial membranes.
And by membrane, we're talking about like a layer of, well...
The outer layer of a cell. All cells are self-contained. Otherwise, their guts just spill out, right? So you begin to see in this type of hydrothermal vent, the white smoke, as they're called, the possibility that the first biochemistry occurred not within a cell membrane, but within trapped in rock. And you begin to see the formation of membranes also in that rock-like structure. Now, I mentioned Bill Martin earlier, and also researchers such as Nick Lane and Mike Russell, who works at JPL and NASA. They, and I agree with them, think that you see the first schism in evolution not as free-floating cells, but actually trapped in rock. So at the root of the tree of life, there are three domains of life. There are bacteria, archaea, which look a little bit like bacteria but are fundamentally different. And then there's everything else, the eukaryotes, which includes us, plants, mushrooms, fungus.
Blue whales.
Big whales. Everything apart from bacteria and archaea, right? So the tree splits somewhere into bacteria and archaea, and then we're much later. Now, Bill Martin's model is that split occurs trapped inside the rock at the bottom of the ocean 4 billion years ago. And I think it works. I think this is the best model we have for that origin of life. And that actually the first life forms and the first evolutionary split, the first origin of species, was in fact not a free-living entity at all. It was a life that was bound in rock.
Okay, so at that point, how do you test some of this stuff? Do you recreate, do you go down to thermal vents and look, or do you recreate these things?
No, they're really difficult to get to because they're at the bottom of the ocean. And they also change over time because they're constantly active. They're not stable. Really difficult to do experiments at the bottom of the sea. They're teeming with life, though. I mean, you know, the biochemistry that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, there's papers and pictures and all sorts of new life at hydrothermal vents almost every month.
Right? Yeah, sure. It's incredible. So there are different types of hydrothermal vents, and the biochemistry that I'm talking about only really works at this one specific type, alkali hydrothermal vents called white smokers. But even when they discovered them in 2000, one of the researchers noted that they couldn't see the rock because there was such a thick blanket of bacteria covering them. But yeah, you're right. You can't experiment. You know, observation is step one in science. Experimentation is step two. And it's been remarkable that so few people have actually been doing experiments like this. And I think one of the key experiments, Mike Russell, I mentioned, he's been working on this type of idea for a few years now. But one of the key experiments is going on as we speak by Nick Lane at UCL, just down the road from here. And he's got a grant to fund this experiment, to put together a basic, it's called a bioreactor, but it's actually just basically a glass jar with various pipes going into it to bubble hot and cold water, but also gases in and out. And they've designed a very, very carefully designed piece of ceramic, baked ceramic, which is sponge-like. So as they bake it, you get these little pores forming, which are like the rock that you get in these types of vents. And the idea is to run some of the gases, like hydrogen sulfide, like methane, through this system, run hot and cold water like you would get at a hydrothermal vent, and just run it, and then take off samples from various points over the ceramic, you know, in the swill, and look to see what molecules emerge. Because if you start to see the molecules that you see in biochemistry, then you're beginning to see the potential for metabolism to start.
So what constitutes proof, though? Because it's tough to say that even if you start to get the molecules of biochemistry, and Miller and Urey got those molecules too, to some extent, what makes someone like Nick Lane's experiment proof if it works compared to the earlier ones?
Well, it's because they're asking a different question. They're asking a question about the origins of metabolism rather than the origins of, for example, Miller's experiment, the origins of proteins. Well, I mean, they weren't specifically asking that question, but that's what emerged from their soup. Nick's experiment is not a soup, right? Because it's not just putting the ingredients together and hoping you get something biological. What it's doing is creating a continuous disequilibrium of energy, and that's what cells are. It is the maintenance of different level energetic levels on one side of a membrane from the other. That is the basic biochemistry that I've been alluding to about how cells harness energy. It happens in mitochondria, and it's the maintenance of more protons, which are hydrogen atoms, on one side of a membrane from the other. And the flow of them across this membrane is where we get all of our energy from. So if you can see that sort of maintained energy flow in this rock-like substance, in the ceramic in this experiment, but in the rocks around the vents themselves, then you're not asking for biochemistry that is reacted, which is what the Miller-Urey experiment did. You're asking to see if there's the emergence of continuous energy generating, harnessing type activity. So you say, what constitute proof? Well, we're a long way from that. So it's looking for the first clues. These are the experimental setups which are looking, you know, really searching for the first clues, and then Nick will adjust some of the settings and see what other molecules emerge from it.
I guess another question is how long might that take? Because if that setup is, for example, the way that life began in the bottom of the ocean, you know, 4 billion years ago, then it might have taken a million years from the beginning of the sort of what the vent appearing to the first what we would call life, even in those little cavities.
Yeah,
I mean, he's not got a million years to sort of sit there and wait for it to happen.
No, that's very true. But so the first time around, we had a long time. It might have been, you know, many millions of years for that experiment.
It might have happened more than once.
It may have happened many, many times. It only survived once. The difference is that they're designing it. You know, Nick is designing this, the the experimental setup in order to optimize the question that he's asking, right? So he's saying, well, is it hydrogen sulfide or is it another gas or is it, you know, what is the exact constitution of the ocean, the liquid that it's around? So it's a proper experiment in that sense. You're actually fiddling with the variables to see what the outcome is going to be. And, you know, he doesn't know none of us knows what the outcome is going to be. And it might be that this is not going to work at all. You're right, we don't have a million years to do it. And I hope to see some results damn sight sooner than that.
For edition two of the book, you mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, I am pushing him to get on with it. But as soon as that experiment gets started and you begin to see clues, if indeed we will see clues to that answer, then, you know, you modify the design. The swill of the ocean is something that would have remixed all of those ingredients, you know, perpetually. But it only has to have worked once. We know that it worked successfully. It may have happened many times, but we know it only worked continuously successfully once. So, you know, we'll see. Suck it and see. That's what science is about.
So we get down to this then about what life is. I started by asking about, you know, what life, how do you define life, and kind of there isn't a definition. But the one that I think you've been talking about, and maybe it's worth unpacking now, is this disequilibrium of entropy, essentially, between inside and outside. And, you know, we've mentioned physics as not having a unifying theory, of course, slightly tongue-in-cheek, but this is a physics idea.
Yes, it is.
This is the application of the second law of thermodynamics to chemicals, basically. And then if they go against the law of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, rather, in other words, they conserve, they decrease local entropy, which, you know, is not allowed.
Yeah.
Then, in a sense, you've got life. So take us through that.
Yeah, I mean, so there's two ways of approaching this. One is the sort of slightly eloquent and beautifully descriptive way that you've alluded to there, and the other is the straightforward biochemistry.
I like the fact you said you alluded to, because it was clearly a shit description that I just said.
Well, you know, this is
the one you pointed at.
This is hard stuff, and I'm not a physicist, and I spent a lot of time working out how to sell this story in the book, how to write it in such a way that anyone can get hold of it. But I deal with the biochemistry very quickly. It's hard. It's called the Krebs cycle or the citric acid cycle, and it's really serious biochemistry. It's the stuff of nightmares when you're a first year. Yes, definitely
exactly.
That. But when you're an undergraduate, you know, I decided in writing the book not to mention the words the Krebs cycle, despite the fact that everything I'm writing about in that chapter is the Krebs cycle, because there are other ways to describe it. Now, the physical way, the second law of thermodynamics way to describe it is, as you say, the measure of the second law of thermodynamics is an increase in what's called entropy. The principle is that energy will only ever flow from a hot body to a colder body and never in the other direction. Right? So it's a universal law. It is one that we can't fight. Life is the only thing that we know of that successfully battles it. It doesn't create a reduction in entropy, but it slows down the increase in entropy. The example that I use, and I don't know whether it fully works, but I think it's quite neat, is in gambling, you go to a casino, the rule is, as everyone knows, that the house always wins. What life does is manage to continually win a little back, slow down the house's, or, you know, it's a continual winning streak that has lasted 4 billion years. And as far as we know, life is the only thing that has managed to do that. As soon as you die, your metabolism stops, the Krebs cycle craps out, and you totally submit to the will of the second law of thermodynamics. Your entropy is released and it increases. But maintained in every single cell that has ever existed, there is order, and there is maintained order, and it's passed on from cell to cell, from organism to organism. And so my reluctance to come up with a definition of what life is, the most eloquent way that I can say underlies the living process is that life is the opposite of decay.
And is that idea something that's been well established for a while? Because, I mean, people have been discussing this obviously for a long, long time, but I wonder, this idea of life being defined as something that conserves local entropy, maybe decreases local entropy.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
well, Schrodinger came up with it. So Schrodinger is the first person to really formalize that, and that's in 1943 or 44. And it's a complex idea. He was approaching it as a physicist. A lot of his ideas in there are slightly odd, a physicist's take on biology. But I think fundamentally he's understood the bottom line about entropy flow. as far as I'm aware, it wasn't really discussed for a long time for, again, complex sociological scientific reasons, one of which almost inevitably was the biggest discovery in science that has ever occurred, which was
the Higgs boson.
Shut up, physicist. The double helix in the 20th century. I'll give you the 21st century. In the 20th century was the double helix. And so when that happens, as soon as that happens, you've got the birth of genetics, right? And so almost all biology from 1953 onwards is about genetics.
So you forget about the other stuff for a while.
Yeah. I mean, and it relates to everything. Genetics underlies all proteins. So all diseases become...
Well, we're barely getting to the beginning of genetics, honest.
We're stuck into it, but I think we've just worked out how little we know. I think that's been the biggest advance in genetics in the last few years.
Yeah. well, at least physics goes forward like that.
funny things, when you start... I didn't include it in the book in the end, but I got slightly interested in the way people referred to themselves as scientists, the names they gave themselves, and because they slowly change over time. And so there was a period where you'd describe yourself as a physiologist, and during my career as a scientist, which was 10 years ago, I was in the lab, there were still people who called themselves cell biologists, right? And then no one really calls themselves a cell biologist anymore.
So what are you now if you're used to be a cell biologist?
Genetics often took over because, you know, almost all cell biology has underlying genetics, because all of the actions of cells are encoded in genes. And so instead of working with proteins or with cell membranes, people started working with DNA that encoded those types of things. So everyone became a geneticist, and then they specialized. So you'd be a cancer biologist or working on a particular metabolic pathway. And labels are often not very helpful, but I just thought it was interesting that people stopped being cell biologists. They stopped looking at cell. I'm totally perplexed as to why this cornerstone of biology, cell theory, is not as controversial as evolution, because it says exactly the same thing. It says that all life is derived from the cell that it came from, you know, and you can follow that tree all the way back to the origin of life. It says exactly the same thing as evolution by natural selection. But no one, I don't even remember being taught cell theory, but everyone gets taught evolution, and it is controversial. If I was a creationist and really clever politically, I'd go after cells rather than genes. Because, you know, everyone would be totally flummoxed by this. Who is this cell creationist?
Cell creationist? It sounds slightly, like some sort of international terror group. let's get back to the science.
Yeah, sure.
rather than creating new movements against science.
Sorry about that. Don't form the cell creationist club, please.
It's worth talking also just maybe about... So Nick Lane's experiment, you talked about hydrothermal vents, et cetera, et cetera. They're going on now, and you think that they're the best current explanation we have. I mean, to be proved, but, that's the best one so far. But, of course, life might have started in lots of ways, and only one survived. Obviously, we're the only survivor. The life on Earth now is from Luca, and Luca was the only one that survived. But other forms of life might have happened. So,
yeah.
You know, there's no evidence, of course, that other types of DNA exist, or that there are different chemical processes or different biochemistry. But is that possible?
Certainly. I think it's a really interesting question to ask. So you're absolutely right. There is no evidence for any life form that doesn't use the tools that we've been describing, DNA, proteins, RNA, cells, all that sort of stuff. That's not to say that it never existed, but it has been outcompeted at some point. If it did exist, it has been outcompeted and doesn't exist anymore. Some people speculate that it might. There's this concept called the shadow biosphere, which sounds awesome, but is science fiction, as far as I'm concerned, because there is no evidence.
There's no evidence. Or the one bit of tantalizing evidence that came along a few years ago turned out to be wrong. Yes.
So it's a really interesting question whether it could have existed. Could you make life forms that used similar underlying principles but different biological molecules? And in fact, that is one of the directions that researchers are looking at. So many labs around the world, but some of the best work is going on at the LMB in Cambridge, that Nobel factory. And they're designing new genetic material. They're basing it on what DNA does successfully and tweaking it or altering it or putting new letters of code in or changing the shape of it slightly. And with some, you know, with some really notable success. Last year, a group led by a guy called Phil Holliger and Victor Pinheiro published a paper in Science in which they introduced the concept of basically synthetic genetics, a new field, which was taking nucleic acid, which is the NA of DNA, but not using the D bit, using what they refer to as X. So they call them XNAs. And they're just a different version of genetic material, and they've produced active bits of genetic material that are not based on DNA. Now that's done entirely experimentally, and is wonderful because it shows that there are alternatives. And to answer your first question, quite plausibly, DNA wasn't the only way to do this. It's just the only way that survived.
Do you think that those sorts of things, though, are... I mean, the second bit of your book is about synthetic biology, and we've discussed that, obviously, before lots of times. And so, you know, we don't need to go into it too deeply now, but these XNAs, for example, and this engineering of DNA and our sort of virtual... people are getting really good at manipulating DNA and encoding things and building DNA and synthesizing it and so on, which is at the root of synthetic biology, of course. Are these different types of DNA one of the avenues in there? Could they be useful for those things, or is it just a scientific curiosity?
No, I think they will be. And in fact, the Cambridge experiments to create XNAs are slightly different from another version of this, which is to create new letters of code. So there are four letters of code in DNA, A, T, C, and G. But groups around the world, Steve Benner being one of them, have increased that alphabet by several new letters. I think we're up to about seven or eight now, so you've got A, T, C, G, Z, P, and other letters. And, you know, again, getting them to work as a language hasn't yet happened. So, you know, we could sit here and add two new letters to the English alphabet now just by drawing them on a piece of paper. They wouldn't mean anything, right? Because we wouldn't know how to pronounce them, and there would have to be a consensus that would agree on how to pronounce them and what, you know, how they changed our language. So those letters in the new DNA don't mean anything yet, but they have got to the stage where they can get them to replicate. They can get them to do one of the things that DNA does, which is to replicate itself. Now, in a sense, we've been sort of fiddling around with this type of idea for a while for the specific reason of treating certain diseases, such as cancer therapies, but also in a much more mundane way, acyclovir, which is the active ingredient in cold sore remedies like blisters and things like that. That contains a letter of DNA which is altered so that when the virus comes in, the herpes virus comes in and tries to replicate, it uses one of these duff letters, and that shuts down the process. It's like a full stop in the middle of a sentence. If I just introduce an error into the middle of a sentence, and it just stops it right there and then. So we're already thinking, we've already got applications for different types of genetic code. It's just that we've got to the stage with our artisan level of skills in molecular biology are such that, you know, we're just rewriting it, the whole lot.
Does that stuff, though, make new life? Are we going to create new life at some point using the stuff we know about genetics and synthetic genomics and all these things? Will we ever do it at some and is there any point to doing that?
Well, I can't think of a reason why not, but why we won't be able to do that. I think it's quite a long way off, because...
Oh, and explain why you think that Venter, for example, hasn't created life. Because Venter, of course, famously claimed to have created a life form with Cynthia a couple of years ago.
Yeah. It doesn't really count as synthetic biology as far as I'm concerned, although I've already said that I'm not that fussed about definitions. But I don't think he created a new life form. He did build a cell that contravenes the first law of cell theory. It's probably the first cell that has ever existed that wasn't born from an existing cell. Right?
Although it used the components of an existing
cell. But it totally used the components. So the genome itself was manufactured by a computer. It was designed by hand and manufactured by a computer. He then injected that into the chassis of an existing cell from a very closely related but different organism, a different bacteria, and booted it up, and it lived, right? So it didn't have a direct lineage from one parent, as almost all bacteria do, or from two parents from sexual beings do. But that made it very different and a huge technological achievement. But I don't think he created life.
Okay, well, let's wind up with a question about, you know, why you think any of this stuff is important in terms of working out this moment of spark. I mean, there is a curiosity, of course. Same question as to why, you know, working out where the Big Bang, how the Big Bang happened, or, you know, what's the fabric of reality in physics? And physicists always ask these questions. So it's, I think, worth turning to that. What would we gain as a species by learning where it all started from?
Well, it's the big one, isn't it? I mean, as I said, we sussed out that we've got these grand unifying theories of biology as it exists. They already exist. You know, everything changed in 1859 with the publication of The Origin of Species. We suddenly had a really robust understanding of how all life has evolved, which is pretty fundamental. This is the big remaining question in intellectual terms. How did life start? There are no bigger questions in biology than this. So that's one reason enough. It's also a really culturally important thing. So it is exactly related to, you know, your physicist's question of how did the universe begin. And that's a very exciting field, and we are edging closer and closer to it. This is the biological equivalent of that. Where did the living universe start?
You're right. I mean, it is one of the big questions, I suppose. But fundamentally, though, if we do find a plausible, provable way of thinking this is how life on Earth started, it gives us license then to hope that there's life elsewhere as well, surely. And if it's just a chemical process, well, in fact, it is just a chemical process. We know that. I'm not suggesting anything else. Then, you know, we've got potential to look elsewhere, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's astrobiology.
And that's even more exciting in terms of, like, the future.
Yeah, well, I'm sticking on Earth for this book. I thought that getting off-world was just a whole nother nightmare. But yeah, you're right, you know, and curiosity is up there now, looking to see what chemicals it can find, to see if any of them are traces of life. It's not looking for life, it's not really kitted out to look for life, but it might be able to detect the chemical signatures of things that life does. The whole field of astrobiology is about looking at what the basic principles of life on Earth are like in order that we might be able to detect them off-world. There's no reason to believe that we'd see the same types of molecules. There's no reason to believe that we would see DNA or RNA or proteins. I find it difficult to think of another mechanism other than evolution by natural selection, because it's such a powerful idea about how life changes. So we might expect to see that sort of process. I also think that, you know, based around this whole conversation, whatever we're looking for, we should be looking for the hallmarks of metabolism, the hallmarks of reducing entropy flow. And that, to me, is the key to what is the basis for life. And that, to me, is the key to what we should be looking at when we get to extrasolar planets.
Okay, well, that's a good point to end. Adam, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Robert.
Creation, The Origin of Life / The Future of Life is out now, published by Viking. That's it for this edition of Science Weekly. For breaking science news at any time, of course, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science. This podcast was produced by Jason Phipps. I'm Alok Jha. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.